Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of December. Former Vice President Walter Mondale is our guest this hour, and he has written a thoroughly engaging, and actually it's a great history book, too. It's a memoir. It's titled The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. He came of age, he writes, in a period when our country brimmed with hope and generosity, a confident people following optimistic leaders achieved a revolution in civil rights, declared a war on poverty, put astronauts in orbit, guaranteed health care for the elderly, reformed a bigoted and outdated immigration system, placed women on the path toward equality with men, and launched the movement known as environmentalism. I might add, he was a big friend of Gaylord Nelson's, Walter Mondale was. But he has also, he says, lived through a period of crippling cynicism and division. So we talk about all of that, and Vice President Mondale has a long history to talk about here this hour, and a fascinating one. He was a U.S. Senator from Minnesota for a number of years, Vice President of the United States with Jimmy Carter when he was president, a state attorney general. He did some very important work in that position, and U.S. ambassador to Japan. He lives in Minneapolis, and he teaches at the University of Minnesota and chairs the board of the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Foundation. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Vice President Mondale. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Vice President Mondale, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, great pleasure. I really enjoyed your book. You have lived through quite a time, haven't you, when you think about it?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that really helped write this book was the first-class Minnesota Historical Society that has the best records and keeps all these materials that can be collected. And I think Wisconsin has a similar high dedication to your historical society. And we're going to talk about a lot of things, I'd like to just say thank you to all of those people who make this kind of good history available and possible.
Yeah, it's terrific. You talk about optimistic leaders in that sentence that I read, and I can think of nobody, and I know he had a huge influence on your whole life. You're going into politics. Optimistic leader, you think of Hubert Humphrey.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
He was the politics of happiness. Remember, he...
Right.
And it wasn't phony for him. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He just... had to be around people. He loved to listen, and he had a heart. If people had problems, he tried to help, and he did. And he had great energy, and so he always made me optimistic.
Would it be fair to say that it was because of Hubert Humphrey that you entered political service?
Pretty close, I would say, because I got started as a young student at McAllister College. And a professor there said, you ought to go over to Minneapolis where this new mayor, Hubert Humphrey, is going to speak. And he was on the faculty here at McAllister. And I went over there and listened to him, and I got hooked. And Hubert and I were close for the rest of our joint lives.
Mm-hmm. You write, skipping ahead in the book, but it was a profound time that you lived through. In retrospect, you are convinced that it was Vietnam and the inability to break with Johnson that finally destroyed Humphrey's best chance to be president. This is an interesting time in your political history as well, because he was a very good friend of yours, and you wanted him to be president, but you knew that something wasn't right with Vietnam.
He did, and he, as you know, the history now available shows that Humphrey sent a long memo to Johnson predicting what he thought would happen if they escalated in Vietnam. All of that came true, and then Humphrey had the bad luck of being in the vice president's office under a strong-willed president. And Humphrey, in his own memoirs, say, I know what happened. He said people thought I was soft, that I wasn't strong enough. But he said, I tried the best I could, but I don't think it looked that way. But I personally wish that Humphrey had never been vice president. He was, by everyone's agreement almost, one of the most influential, impressive, decent public leaders in the country. His independence was essential to that, and he lost that during those 4 years of vice presidency, and I don't think he ever got the same feeling of the same stature and the same feeling of satisfaction from public life that he had before.
Mm-hmm. I recall, and I've told this story about him many times on the air because I've done radio for years and years. Sheriff Artisan, who was our sheriff here, some in Milwaukee will remember him, some years ago, was the head of the Secret Service detail for yes. Vice President Hubert Humphrey. And he recalled going to a meeting when he was giving him protection of Native American leaders in this country. And by golly, the vice president knew every single name of yeah. every tribe leader in the room.
He would. I don't know how he did that, but he would remember names of people who he met when they're 12 years old, they're now adults.
Oh, my gosh.
It's kind of alchemy, and he didn't have any tricks. It was just a wonderful memory. The story I love to tell is about Barry Goldwater, who was a friend of Humphrey's, and he said, you know, Humphrey has been clocked in his speeches at 250 words a minute. He said, with gusts up to 400. He could kick it up.
Yeah, right. And I want to move into your years as vice president. You did meet with Hubert Humphrey because you were thinking about vice president. There was a chance that you would be named to be vice president, and you spent an hour-long meeting with him.
I did.
And he talked about the role of the vice presidency. Tell me about your thoughts about becoming vice president and what he had to say.
Frankly, because of the experience that Humphrey had had, I was very skeptical about whether I wanted to leave the Senate where I was my own man. And I went to see Hubert, and he had an entirely different take on it. He said, you know, I know more about my country. I think I'm a better public leader. I think I grew during my years in the White House, and you will too. And he said, you can do more for your country in one day in that office than you can do for it in a year in the Senate. And he said, so think about it. And so that had a big impact on me. And then my talks with Carter went well, so I decided to do it.
You sure did. There you were.
Yeah.
The other thing that you write about, and I'm interested in this time period and how things, so much was accomplished. You were in the Senate at this time of great liberal revival and civil rights and women and all kinds of issues. And you started as in Minnesota dealing with civil rights issues as well.
Right.
A great liberal time in the Senate.
Well,
how did it happen?
It was kind of a Minnesota-Wisconsin thing, too, you know.
Right.
We're all in it together, and old Gaylord Nelson and Dave Obey, and the list is long. We were working together, and we had the same progressive traditions, and it was a real, we got two for one there. And I would say it was several things. It was a long accumulation of unmet needs. Civil rights being a classic example, over two centuries, and we still had many parts of the country where the laws officially required separation so that you couldn't get on the bus in the right way, you couldn't use restrooms, you couldn't use any kind of public transportation, somebody called the politics of rage. They'd back this up by violence, and you could lose your life asserting. And that was lasted right into the 60s in America, if you can believe it. And it had to be changed. We finally changed that. We did a lot of things. But I think the public had watched this accumulation of unmet needs in America. And finally the dam broke in the 60s. And people like Gaylord Nelson and so on from Wisconsin, and Hubert and I and McCarthy, and so we were all set to go.
You were all set to go.
Yep.
Tell us about, because you were intimately involved in this, and it's such a dramatic moment in Democratic politics, the Freedom Committee from Mississippi,
yes,
asking to be seated at the Democratic National Convention, and you were on the Credentials Committee, weren't you?
I was on the Credentials Committee, and I ended up chairing the subcommittee dealing with the Freedom Democratic Party challenge. Mississippi was segregated. The delegation they sent to Atlantic City was, I think, all white, and very few of them intended to vote for our candidates. They would vote for Barry Goldwater. And so there was no virtue I could see in their candidacy. The Freedom Democrats arrived and presented themselves as an alternative delegation to be seated, and there were no sort of rules and precedent for that. And here's what we did. We changed the rules of the Democratic Party by what we call the Civil Rights Act for the parties that prohibited all future discrimination, refusal to seat any delegation that was picked on a segregated basis, and other rules to make it more open. And we would only seat Mississippi regular delegates who signed a pledge that they would support Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey, knowing that none of them would, and they didn't. And we seated national committeemen and committee women. There was two seated, black and white, and we declared that from here on out, we were insisting on a non-segregated delegation selection committee. So while the Freedom Democratic Party was not seated there, and there was some anger about that, the decision that we reached had the support of Martin Luther King and almost all the civil rights leaders, and it led to this profound change in the South,
yes,
including in Mississippi, where since then they've all been integrated. Usually 50% or more of the delegates are black.
And it also led to a profound change in national politics,
oh,
because
yes,
the South was no longer Democratic territory.
What happened was that the Democratic Party really had been hypocrites. We were all for civil rights, but we didn't do anything about the violation of civil rights in the South. And we had many Southern segregationists who were nominal Democrats. Strom Thurmond, Jesse Helms, the list is long. But as soon as we came clean on that issue and said there will be no more segregated delegations and the other steps we took, almost all of them jumped immediately to the Republican Party. And the South that had been a solid Democratic region, solid South, they called it, suddenly became the solid South, but it was Republican.
Mm-hmm. How did this issue, Vice President Mondale, become important to you? You, after all, you're from Minnesota.
Right.
Minnesota is a pretty white state.
Right. I would say, I grew up in a family of a liberal Methodist minister, old Lutheran, who became a Methodist minister. And he felt that segregation was wrong and taught all of us that. And from high school, I felt that way. And then everybody I worked with in politics, Hubert, we had Clarence Mitchell from Minnesota. We had several of the Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP. This is a small state, but we had an inordinate presence in the civil rights fights. And that's one of the proudest, I think, periods for Minnesotans, because we really did do something for that.
Yes, you did. And you did something for the country. I love the fact that your father, I believe it was, thought that fighting Bob La Follette was a hero.
Oh, I remember. he took us through the nation's capital. We had to look at those favorite sons statues there. And I don't think he liked the Minnesotan one too much. But when we got to, he stopped. Finally, we got to Bob La Follette. He said, "Now here's the man that made the difference." So I got the scripture right there.
Former Vice President Walter Mondale is our guest, longtime U.S. Senator, ambassador to Japan. He's welcoming phone calls, too. We'll start taking phone calls for him momentarily. His book has just been released, Walter F. Mondale, The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Vice President Mondale. Mary from Stockbridge, our first caller. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Kathleen and Vice President Mondale. What an honor to be able to ask you a question.
Thank you, Mary.
My question is, I was born in the 50s, a late baby boomer, and I grew up in the progressive liberal age of politics that you were talking about, and cheered the civil rights movement and the changes that took place during that time. My question to you is, it seems to me that the needs of the people are also extremely great right now. In your opinion, why do you think that the political view is shifting so radically? I mean, you know, we had the Obama election just a few years ago, and now it's this past election, it's shifted dramatically to the other side.
Well, it is stunning. I thought when Obama got elected, we'd have a cycle there when we could get a lot of things done that were talked about in the campaign with the huge new margins in the Congress. We had what was needed. We picked up a lot of seats in legislatures and so on around the country. It looked like we had what we needed to do to get momentum, and we did get some things done, like the health care bill and many of the big things that we did. But then it seemed like a reaction set in, and I think it's caused above all by hard times. When people are unemployed, people are in danger of losing their homes, people are finding it hard to get pensions and health care, they're afraid about their jobs going overseas. The middle class is under real pressure in America. The school systems are not producing at the same high level that the nation needs. There's a lot of things like that, and I think people are unhappy. And they, so we had this revolt in this last election. Certainly you in Wisconsin felt it, and we had quite a bit of it here in Minnesota, well across the country. And it's like we're thrashing around as a people trying to decide what we should do now. Last week it seemed to be all about cutting national spending. That's what we had to do. But this week it's about cutting taxes that would cost a deficit $700-800 billion, but that's what we have to do. And we are told, and I don't have the answer, and I've got some ideas, but I'll tell you that I'm very optimistic because I think we'll work our way out of this. We've been through bad times before, and American people figure it out. But one thing that worries me is this, and it's new and it's different from the past, and that is that we now allow corporations to give secretly from their treasuries in unlimited amounts in American political campaigns. And a lot of this was done for the first time in this last election. We haven't allowed that since Teddy Roosevelt. And now it's back again. Is it possible that this country that's based on a government, as Lincoln put it, of the people, by the people, and for the people, in other words, push come to shove, the public will decide. That's the basic American genius. Is it possible that we could damage that whole ideal by allowing so much of this money to be brought to bear on public decision-making that we lose the basic public control that our founders wanted? Is the chance that we could damage our system so much that we'd be something different, basically, than we've been before? My answer is no, it's not going to happen that way, but I do worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Are there any historical lessons? You write extensively, and you were involved in this era of history. We mentioned the incredible liberal agenda, and much of it was passed in the 60s. And then, you know, with few exceptions, the Carter administration and you, 2 decades of retreat from government activism. What caused that?
Well, I would say that we got a lot more done in our 4 years through the use of government than people remember. If you look at how many measures we passed, like the energy bills, the bills that we passed on education, the sweeping changes we made in the environment, and many, many other changes, not to count the breakthrough in China and the Panama Canal and the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty and the human rights emphasis and so on. What we did ranks very well with our other progressive presidents, but the public didn't feel that way about us, and I don't think we're very good at talking about it. And as now, we were going through tough economic times, and I think that's what people tend to look at.
Yeah. Mary, thanks for your call. We go next to Leroy. Hi, Leroy.
Hello, Ted. How are you this morning?
How are you, Leroy?
President Mondale, I'm originally from Racine, Wisconsin,
yep.
BP, and I had the honor as a president of a local founder, Racine Steel Castings, and I was on the city council there campaigning for you and Ray Majerus, who was the UAW director for Region 10 at that time,
yep.
Elected my foundry for you to take a tour. And when I heard this morning, I was elated the WPR and Kathy put you on. I've been wondering where you been, but it was memorable, and I took you to the foundry, and now I'm retired, 83 years old.
Great.
And I took you up there. We're tapping the furnace and used that molten metal, 27,000 degrees. And I gave you from a memorial from our union a white hard hat. And
yeah.
You walked by to think of me, and we think of you, and you did a great job, and you fought a great fight. So I just want to praise you for that, and I wish we had someone like yourself coming through these times to get the public media to the public side of what you've done for this great country. And thank you. And have a nice trip back to Minnesota.
Oh, Leroy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Leroy.
And, you know, I remember Ray Majerus. He was my buddy. He used to take me around there.
Oh.
And wonderful to hear about those stories.
Yeah, and that he remembers you pretty deeply all these years later.
Yep.
That's wonderful. That's great. Let's go to Kathy from Milwaukee next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Kathleen. What an honor to speak to you, Vice President Mondale.
Thank you, Kathy. Great.
In Kathleen's introduction, she really kind of included what my frustration has been as she described that era and how many of us were influenced by the early 60s mm-hmm. and the leaders of those times. Right now, I just find in the last several years, our country is just so depressed, apathetic, negative. It's just so sad. And so when I speak to young people, I usually say to them, you know that the world doesn't have to be like this. And so I wondered, how do you deal with what you are observing today, with what wonderful times in the early 60s that we experienced, including like now when you were talking about being from Minnesota and being influenced by your dad to be involved in social issues?
Yeah.
What do you tell yourself when you see us today?
Well, I always think that things are going to get better, that people will see that we're not moving along the way we should, and that as in the past, we will be resourceful and we'll change. One of the things that curses our times is the harsh partisanship. Every issue has to be almost viciously divisive in American life. That was not true in our time. We had our debates, as we should, but we were able to resolve them, and most of the issues we worked on, all the fundamental issues, we had bipartisan leadership that worked on it. So I think the public liked that because it was more, when we did it, an American answer than some political answer. So we've got to work on this issue. I think when you convert a political issue that friends can fight over into a religious issue, where the issue can, if you're not careful, becomes one of good versus evil, you kill debate, and it leads to a kind of a rigidity and harshness that I don't think it doesn't work. The other thing is, I think we need to change the U.S. Senate rules. Gaylord and I worked on that when we were in the Senate. Right now, you got to get 60 votes for almost anything you want. Maybe you could get a Mother's Day resolution through with fewer votes, but right now, and nothing's passing. It's an absolute deadlock down there. It's the center aisle is more like the Great China Wall.
Oh.
It's not like what we had. So we need to change these things, and I've testified last year in the Senate about these changes. The other thing is we got to do something about big money. I think big money is now so pervasive and so profound that it cripples our ability to get things done. And we got to work on all that.
I want to talk to you a little more about what I see as a signature issue of your time as vice president and President Carter was the energy issue in this country. And we were experiencing very long gas lines. Yep. And he was very concerned about this issue, and contrast it with, we did a show on the Cancun conference a couple days ago, how few American politicians are sending anybody to the conference.
Yep.
It's way off the table now, even though it's an enormously large issue. What are your thoughts about that, and what you and the Carter administration did to advance energy independence and alternative energy?
As you know, Carter, right from the start, talked about our energy crisis, our dependency on foreign oil, the way we're sending American resources overseas, the way these issues can lead to war and tensions, and that we had to get our own energy house in order. Almost all, we set up the Department of Energy, almost all the alternative energy efforts were begun under Carter. I'm talking about solar, geothermal, wind, almost everything you can think about we got started in a serious way under Carter. It was very painful, but we deregulated the price of gas and oil so that the market would be a factor in reducing the wastage of energy. And we did a lot of other things to try to, we set up the energy oil reserve so that we couldn't be blackmailed. And we, by the time our 4 years were over, we were using 2 million barrels a day less of foreign oil than we were on the day we took office.
Hmm.
So we made real progress, and it was just the beginning. If we'd kept those policies in place, we'd be in a far different place than we are now. But Reagan, he had this idea that there was no problem. It was just, there's more oil, he used to say, in Alaska than all the other rest of the world combined. All we have to do is drill it and so on. It was just, it didn't work, but we lost a lot of time in the process. And now, here we are, much more dependent on foreign oil. The American future is going overseas to pay for all this energy. And a lot of the places where we're sending the money gets in the hands of people who don't wish us well. And we simply have to do something to regain American control over our energy resources.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Deborah in Madison. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I feel like I'm so pleased to be able to talk to you.
Thank you, Deborah.
I feel like I'm calling and asking for a story, and I am. I heard an interview with you some years back. You described something that happened to you when you were in Germany on a radio program, and the discussion turned to when you used to fly bombing sorties over Europe, and a very fateful day when you had to make the decision to drop your payload. And I heard you tell this story. Are you?
Yeah, no, I know the story, but it was George McGovern.
Right.
Because McGovern had been a bomber pilot, decorated hero, and he was on a run where he had to drop his load in order to get back to safety. And that's, I'm sure that's the story you heard.
Mm-hmm. And he's a good friend of yours. Jimmy mm-hmm. Carter is still a very good friend of yours.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's part of the fun, finally retiring from public life. You have your old friends to swap stories with. And George is around now. He's writing another book, I think.
Is he really?
Yeah.
He just keeps going. Mm-hmm. So do you. Are you still the official dog walker? Do you still have
I do that.
You do?
I work for our dog. I try to be a loyal servant.
I have one of those kind of dogs, too.
Oh, this one is,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
That's another Wisconsin problem. I bought this dog from a English setter from Baldwin, Wisconsin. There's a wonderful dog trainer there. And I asked him if he ever got a dog, a setter that could be a pet. You know, they're usually so strung up. And he said, I'll look for one. That's how I got our dog. And she's a wonderful dog.
Oh, it's nothing like a good dog, right?
No,
they get you through a lot.
Absolutely.
You through a lot. Mike is next from Shorewood. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. It's wonderful being on with you, Vice President.
Thank you, Mike.
I have a question. I'm on my way to a meeting of the Common Cause State Board in Wisconsin. And we are looking for ways to somehow rescue campaign finance reform. And we have people of goodwill of both parties in Common Cause, as I'm sure you well know. And I'm wondering if you can give us either the board or progressives in general any ideas for specific strategies to overcome the Citizens United decision that you spoke about earlier. Because obviously, if money flows unregulated and unreported into campaigns, money will rule. And do you have any strategies or any thoughts about ways that that can be overcome?
Mike, I write about it a little bit in the book. The Citizens United case, I think, has dire implications for American democracy. Nobody knows how all of this secret money that comes out of treasuries can influence the decisions. And now, you know, a lot of big corporations have a lot of foreign investors and board members and so on. America has never allowed foreigners to be involved in the political process. That's something we always kept to ourselves. I think there's some dangers there. I would like to see the Supreme Court reverse its opinion. Maybe someday we can get the judges that'll do, because it's obviously a terrible mistake. But I would work on, one, getting full disclosure. I think whenever corporate money is used, it ought to be reported immediately from what corporation, or how much, and in being spent in what way. So the public at least has the information that it can use to pass its own judgment about the candidates and about that money. I would like to see some kind of matching mechanism where if a person takes, if a candidate takes this money out of the matching fund, would come an equivalent that would go to the candidate against whom this money is being spent. That, if you could get something like that passed, that could help a lot. You know, the but basically, and I would like to try a constitutional amendment. There's several polls that show the public is not for this. They're worried about it. It's so alien to American law. We just never allowed this in basically in American history. And I think it's come as a shock to people. And I think we should try a constitutional amendment.
Aspect to this, and I agree with you, and perhaps if the public really does oppose this, it's possible even under present conditions with the new power shift in Washington. How about reapportionment? Reapportionment every 10 years has resulted in gerrymandered districts that keep the great proportion of seats safe. Do you see any hope? Now, some states, Iowa, for example, has rewritten its reapportionment rules so that gerrymandering is much, much more difficult. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do. In Minnesota here, several of us have been pushing for redistricting to be done by a impartial bipartisan commission that would redesign the rules and simply send their package up for up or down vote by the legislature and to be signed by the governor. And the idea is to get, the way it is now, the politicians can pick their voters. And the American ideal is that the voters pick the politicians. And we should try to cut the politicians out of designing their own seats. That's a real problem today. And I think it leads to some of this harsh partisanship that we are suffering from. So we passed that in the state Senate last year. We failed to pass it in the House, so we don't have it in Minnesota. But several states are working on this kind of special districting committee idea. And I hope Wisconsin will look at it.
Hmm. Well, I think it's great you're speaking to somebody who's on his way to the Common Cause state meeting and can address the conference today later. Well, in my conversation with Vice President Mondale this morning, this is what he suggested. So you'll add some weight to that meeting. That's great. Thanks, Mike, very much for the call. There's so much to talk about. His book is so rich with reminiscences of bills that were passed. He tells, and I have always been touched, and I remain touched by the story of Nelson Mandela. And I know that Vice President Mondale had called for his release and had meetings with the South African government, which I find extraordinarily interesting. I want to ask him about that. We have an email about his work with Gaylord Nelson, so we'll take many more calls in the minutes that we have left. Vice President Walter Mondale is our guest this hour. For that which we are not able to get to this hour, you can find his reminiscences in The Good Fight, Walter F. Mondale, The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Vice President Walter Mondale is our guest. Here's an email that has come in. I know that Vice President Mondale has a copy of a picture that she took, Kathy in Eau Claire, a photo of Gaylord Nelson waving from a canoe on the Namekagon River. Would you talk about Gaylord and your cooperation on environmental issues and what you see as the biggest environmental threats today?
I've got that picture. We're talking about the same one. We canoed on the Namekagon.
Yes.
When we passed the St. Croix bill, and he went back up and had his picture of him waving from his canoe, and I've got that up in my bedroom.
So
every day I can see Gaylord and salute him.
Oh.
I told Carrie Lee I did that.
Oh, that's a great story.
Gaylord and I were very close. We're good friends, dear friends. And I got a lot of my inspiration for environmental change and reform from him. And we cooperated in all sorts of things, the St. Croix River being an example. But, you know, we worked together to get the tailings out of Lake Superior. We worked together on the Voyageurs National Park. We worked together to get the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts passed, and I adored Gaylord and his gutsy way on his idea about nature was that we had a moral responsibility to protect the beauty and health of our earth, and I believe that, and old Reverend Nelson told me about that all the time.
Oh, I love the fact you have that picture in your bedroom.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to forget him.
No. I want to talk about Nelson Mandela for a moment because I've adored him and I have admired him for so long, and I love the part of the book when you talk about dealing with the South African government calling for the release of Nelson Mandela. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, well, you know, I was meeting with the then Prime Minister of South Africa, give his name in a minute, and they were an apartheid government. That was their idea was that the blacks were supposed to be off in the corner and the government would be run by the whites, and they were very brutal about it. And I met with Forster in Vienna for 3 days, representing the new American administration, in which I told them that we couldn't have good relations with South Africa unless they ended apartheid, unless they released civil rights leaders that they had in their jail, like Nelson Mandela and another fellow named Toivo, and there were a whole bunch of them that they had under arrest for years. And we had a very tough 3 days of, I would say, harsh, confrontational politics. It wasn't the case that we could persuade them to change. We tried to, but at least we could make it clear to South Africa and to the world that the United States believed in civil rights and was willing to do something about it.
Mm.
And I think it helped bring about the change that ultimately released Nelson Mandela and the others, and I'm glad we still got him around.
Yeah, I am too. Quite a man, quite a man. All right, let's go to Lee from Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Hello, and I want hello, Senator.
Hi, Lee.
Mandela, it's sure a pleasure to talk to you. I wanted to first of all say you were probably one of the first people back when you ran against Reagan to warn a budget deficit.
Yeah.
And how the SNL crisis was handled in this off the budget manner.
Yeah.
Also, why didn't we learn anything from that? And then when David Stockman wrote his book, which I still have a copy of, basically backing you up, and he was probably Reagan's number one advisor. How does this? How come Bush was allowed to run all these wars off budget, the two Bushes, and also what radicalized the Republican Party from going in 64 when they were the ones that helped just pass the Voting Rights Act to this totally, almost, so far right wing, it's pathetic. I mean, the people that we sent from our area, I'm totally ashamed of.
Well, you know, we used to have a moderate branch of the Republican Party. And when I was in the Senate, we had, I would say, 25 of those senators were they called themselves Lincoln Republicans. They believed in civil rights. They believed in social justice. And we worked together on all the issues. We wouldn't get it done because the Southern Democrats didn't agree with a lot of that and wouldn't vote with us. So we had to do it together. And that, I think, was a great period for America because we got things done that had to be done. That has disappeared, at least at top levels in American politics now. The divisions in the Senate, in the House, well, you can just, every time you see a debate going, the harshness of the debate, it's something we've got to reclaim here. I talked about it earlier, so I won't talk about it again, but it troubles me greatly.
We have an email that's come in, and this is probably going to bring us close to the end. I hate to have you go, but my time is up.
Yeah, this is fun.
Yeah,
thank
it
you.
It is fun. How do we create a new generation of progressive thought to counteract the anti-government fervor? Is President Obama capable of leading this progressive movement?
Well, we have to do it in our personal lives, talking to our friends, talking to members of our family, participating in meetings and conferences to talk about the issues. I think we need to do it through supporting education. That's not because you make Democrats, but if people will read and listen and learn, they will make wise decisions, and we need to be very careful about that. I talked about money and won't go over against that, but I think that is also a factor. And I still teach at the university. I do it because I like to be around students. I always feel better after I've taught a class. Whether they do or not, I don't know, but I do. Because they are full of hope. They're smart. They're going to change things,
mm-hmm.
and I just feel great about it. So I think if you're just so depressed about it, go teach a class.
Oh, you're terrific. Thank you so much,
thank you.
Vice
I
President
loved it.
Mandel. Yeah.
Thank you very, very much. I loved it.
Good. We
thank
did, too. And the book, in case you would like to read it, and it really is interesting because it looks at, you know, what, and we didn't even talk about his time as Attorney General in Minnesota, where he did some remarkable work and came to the attention of many politicians, including Hubert Humphrey, who played a big role in his life. I love his comments about Humphrey and Nelson. The book is Walter F. Mondale, The Good Fight, A Life in Liberal Politics. It has just been published, and I'm sure that you will find it very interesting. We also forgot to tell him that David Eisenhower, who we had interviewed yesterday, had many kind things to say about him. In case you're still on with him, Chrissy, tell him that David Eisenhower said that he really respected Vice President Walter Mondale and wanted us to say hello. So we're doing that. Well, that was interesting. That about does it for me for this week. We do want to tell you that, you know, we were saddened by Elizabeth Edwards passing this week. I really liked her and respected her. And so we have posted an interview on our Facebook page that we did with her in 2006, was it, or 2007. We interviewed her. A couple books came out. So in case you want to remember her during another time, then you can listen to that. Thanks to Chrissy Pease and Rhonda Fanning. Thanks to Chrissy for producing this hour and for on-air production as well. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. I know the Vice President appreciated them.